Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
For me, a personal really changing moment was my first meal at Chez Panisse. And this was the food I thought food should always be. And it was just tremendously exciting. And that's what made me, I think, really want to take cooking seriously.
That was Deborah Madison, nationally recognized expert on vegetarian cooking, also author of a new book, In My Kitchen, a book that, by the way, puts vegetables on top of the food pyramid where a lot of people think they belong. I'll be speaking with Deborah later in the show. First, it's time to head into the kitchen to check in with Milk Street cook Catherine Smart about this week's recipe. Catherine, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. We're here at Milk Street Kitchen, of course. And J.M. Hirsch, our editorial director, was in Central Mexico recently, in Veracruz in particular. I don't know why I didn't get to go, but he did. And he came back with a few recipes, one of which I really loved was a shrimp in chipotle sauce. It was very simple and it was also foolproof, but we made some changes. So what did we do to the recipe?
Okay, Chris, so you're right. We found this chipotle sauce. It's delicious. It's simple. We wanted to figure out a way to make shrimp tacos that were very hard to mess up. So we start with the sauce. The chipotle sauce is a base of fresh tomatoes and peppers and a little bit of smoky chipotle. And something that I think is worth mentioning is the heat should be smoky, it should be lingering, but it shouldn't eviscerate your taste buds. I mean, in Mexico, the cuisine is really about balancing heat with other flavors. Like here we have the sweetness from the tomatoes, the acidity from some wine. It should be gentle and it should be balanced. So we make that simple sauce. And then for the shrimp, I mean, it's really easy to overcook shrimp. I think we're all guilty of it. So the way that we sort of gave ourselves an insurance policy, we seared the shrimp about 45 seconds on just one side. And so that gives you some browning, it develops some good flavor. And then we add those shrimp, which aren't cooked through yet, you add them to the sauce we made, which is off heat. So then you just have that really gentle residual heat that's gonna cook the shrimp the rest of the way through.
Gentle sauce, gentle heat. I see a theme here.
It's delicious with tacos, a little bit of avocado, some sour cream, maybe a squeeze of lime. It's also great over just plain white rice.
I'll put it over rice and drink the rest of the wine. Catherine, thank you very much. Great recipe.
Thanks, Chris. You can find our recipe for shrimp and chipotle sauce and many other Milk Street recipes at 177milkstreet.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. All of our shows are available on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn, Spotify, and also at our own site, milkstreetradio.com, where you can also download this week's recipe. Now it's time to take some of your cooking questions from my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Of course, she's star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals and also author of Home Cooking 101. Sarah, are you ready for a new batch of phone calls?
Yeah, let's take some calls. Hello, welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Doris Ruth.
Hi, Doris. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Westchester County, New York.
How can we help you, Doris?
I have a problem when I make toffee. The recipe I have doesn't have a temperature, and so sometimes it ends up not being toffee. It ends up being either Dentist Delight, or it ends up being this granular mess that ends up being repurposed.
Are you using a good thermometer to figure out?
She doesn't know what temperature it's supposed to be.
I don't know what temperature. Should it be 300?
No, that's too high.
What kind of sugar is it?
Sometimes it'll work with brown sugar. Sometimes it'll work with white sugar.
What's happening is the sugar syrup's getting overcooked, and that's why it gets really dense. I think, isn't the typical candy crack stage 238, 239?
I should use like a Thermopop. That's what
yes,
I have.
Yes, exactly.
That's pretty accurate.
Yeah, they're great. Thermopan or Thermopop, which is the somewhat less expensive version. And I think 238, 239 is about where it should be. Sarah, is that right?
I'm trying to think because I'm thinking softball stage and then it goes into hard crack.
Right. So I should have it at the softball stage?
What's the ultimate texture you're looking for?
It should be like butter crunch.
Yeah, it should be beyond softball then.
It should crack.
Yeah. So maybe
it should crack.
Yeah. So I'm wrong. It's got to be higher than that.
Yeah. So we're talking about caramel.
Yeah.
We did this article in Gourmet Magazine on burnt sugar, which is nothing more than the British word for caramel. And the way they do it in this particular article was with no water. So you take the sugar.
That's what I do.
You put it in a skillet. You cook it over medium heat, medium high heat. It starts to melt. You can stir it a little bit with a silicone spatula. And then it eventually will turn into caramel. And there's no issues with crystallization. You can see exactly it's the right color.
Where's the butter? You have to use butter.
Just hold on. I have breaking news.
Okay.
I just got online.
Oh, my God. That's cheating. You're supposed to have it in your head.
No.
I went to ThermoWorks candy temperature chart. It says butterscotch and toffee, 270 to 290. Done.
Okay, but so now back to where I've taken her. When do you add the butter? We know that when you make, say, for example, a caramel sauce, you get the sugar to caramel, and then you add the cream, and it all bubbles up.
Well, no, you add just a little bit of the cream at first and whisk it in, and that starts to cool it down, then you add the rest of it slowly. If you don't add all the cream at once, it won't bring the temperature down that fast and harden.
I'm going to be honest with you. I've never done the butter business.
So it's 270 to 290. So I was...
All right.
We were wrong.
When do they have you put the butter in?
You melt the butter, and then you add the brown sugar. I think I just haven't been getting it hot enough. I'm on my fourth batch, and I'm tired of this.
I don't blame you. Oh, my goodness.
Well, try that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, well,
okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for that.
Take care.
Hello, welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Allison.
Hey, Allison, where are you calling from and how can we help you?
I'm calling from Somerville, Massachusetts, and I had a question about cooking fish.
Okay.
The question is whether you should or not, or?
Absolutely
no, not.
Fish. The last couple times I've cooked it, though, it's broken into big chunks before it's done cooking, and it's with a couple different kinds of fish and a couple different cooking methods, so I'm not sure what's going on.
First question is, where do you buy your fish?
I usually go to Whole Foods.
There's a couple great fishmongers down on Cambridge Street. There's New Deal,
okay,
and there's one down from there as well. And if you want really fresh fish, I find the small places tend to be better. How are you cooking the fish, too?
Yeah, I think that's the most important question.
So one time I broiled some salmon, and it was almost done, but seemed like it still needed a couple more minutes, and it started breaking in. By the time I got it into a serving dish, it had pretty much completely fallen apart.
Did you have it on parchment? Did you have it on oiled sheet pan?
I had it on a silicone baking sheet on a sheet pan.
So it wasn't sticking?
No.
Fish, especially oily fish, like tuna, is the worst. If you barely cook tuna, let it sit for 5 minutes, it'll completely finish cooking. You have to cook it really rare, and especially a thick fillet, like salmon's pretty fatty, it will continue cooking somewhat. So you really want to underbake it or undercook it. Secondly, I would use lower heat for fish.
I think broiling is a little violent.
Yeah, broiling is too powerful. I would use very low heat on a grill. I would cook in a skillet over fairly modest heat. Because what's happening is the outside of the fish is overcooking before the inside's done. Just like a big roast, for example, you'd want to use a low oven and take it out before it's cooked and let it sit a few minutes and it will continue cooking.
You know, I wanted to tell you how you can know how much it's cooked. Just pull it out and stick a knife through it. There's not any juices going to come charging out, you know, like you worry about, say, with a steak. And fish cooks from the outside in. So when you stick your knife in it straight down, you should feel a little bit of resistance in the middle. And that means it's slightly undercooked. If the knife barely goes through, it's barely cooked, and put it in some more. But if there's a little bit of resistance in the middle, just get it out and let it rest.
Guys, there's an easier solution to this. Just go buy an instant read thermometer, a good one, digital, and stick it in the middle of the thickest part of the fish, and it should read 125. 120 to 125, you're done. And once it hits that temperature, get it off fast and then let it sit.
Sit.
The only fish you have to really worry about is tuna. I've taken it off rare, barely cooked, and it's, you know, medium well in 10 minutes.
And when it's well done, it's really dry.
And so when you take it off, one thing you need to do is slice it immediately. Because if you don't, if it sits there as a whole tuna steak, it holds temperature. So that's the one fish you have to be really careful with.
I mean, recipes for years have been telling you to broil fish, but I think I wouldn't do it either. I think fish is very delicate.
It's too risky. Lower temperatures give you a bigger window of doneness, if you will. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks
for
calling.
You're welcome.
Bye.
This is Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. If you like your cooking question answered, call us anytime, 1-855-4-BOWTIE or 855-426-9843. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street Radio. Who's calling?
Hi, my name is Steve from Chapel Hill.
How are you?
Great. You don't know how excited I am. I'm trying to contain myself. To talk to both of you, it's like going to heaven.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
I know, really.
It's our pleasure.
Made our day.
I have a kind of a dumb question, but here we go. I love making breaded pork chops. I put them in oil, fry them, and typically what I do is I get them, dunk them in egg wash, and then put them on some panko or something, and then just fry them up. And I notice a lot of recipes call for first flouring them, and I just wondered why that is. I don't do it, and partly just to save on washing dishes, but I'm open to any suggestions y'all have.
When I was in college one summer, I got a job renovating an old farmhouse in northern Massachusetts, and before you actually put on wallpaper and stuff, there's a base coat and spackle. So this is base coat. It's a base coat. You're putting the flour on so the egg sticks better to the pork chop, because sometimes pork chops can be a little wet or moist. If you do a really good job drying them off, however, you could probably get away without it, but that's what it's there. It'll stick better to the flour.
Yeah. It's like extra glue and extra insulation, which helps to protect the lean pork
and it
top.
Does get, when the flour gets a little wet, it gets gluey.
Yeah.
It's sticky.
So it really helps. By the way, this thing where you do flour, egg wash, breadcrumbs is in the, when we go to cooking school, it's called standard breading procedure.
How sexy is that?
I know, really. And you've got to make sure you have a wet hand and a dry hand, because otherwise you bread yourself. But one way around creating a lot of dishes is to put a piece of parchment or a piece of aluminum foil on the counter for the flour and the breadcrumbs. So instead of having three separate pie plates, you know, you have one pie plate for the eggs and then the other two for the dry ingredients. And then all you have to do is pick up the paper with the, you know, breadcrumbs or the flour and dump it in the garbage when you're done.
Wait. Let's go back. The wet hand and the dry hand.
Right.
So how does this work?
Let's say you're going to start with the flour. So that is going to be your dry hand.
So that's my right hand's my dry hand.
Right. Okay. For me, it would be my left. Let's say it's you. That's your dry hand. Yeah. So you use that for the first aluminum foil with the flour, and pat the pork dry. And then you pick it up and you drop it into the pie plate with the beaten eggs. And then you take your left hand and you coat it there. And then you pick it up with your left hand, let the egg drip off. And then you put it in the breadcrumbs without touching. You just drop it. Then you go back to dry hand and lift up. The thing about the parchment is you can lift up the sides of the paper because now it's wet. And if you stuck your hand in it to make sure, you'd get breaded. So you lift up the sides of the parchment and sort of toss it around in the parchment flat on the counter. And when it's mostly coated, then you can finish coating it and take it off.
Oh, it feels like when I do that, I have a woolly mitten on because I have about a half inch of coating on my
hands. Well, I still end up breading myself anyway, but it's just a thought.
Yeah. I like that.
It's a nice extra coating because aside from, you know, the fact that it's a helpful glue so that the crumbs really stay on better, it is more insulation. And as we know, pork has been bred to be the other white meat, so it's very, very lean. And all this insulation really helps it to come out moist.
Well, this is great. I wish you all the best. And thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you, Steve.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. After the break, I speak with Deborah Madison, author of Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone, as well as her latest work, In My Kitchen. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosom, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are, and I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like, it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavors of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded, like, oh, wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just wanted to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now it's time to talk to Deborah Madison. Of course, she's a well-known chef, a writer, a cooking teacher, and also an innovator in vegetarian cooking. She began her career at the San Francisco Zen Center, followed by the opening of Green's Restaurant in 1979. She's also the owner of Cafe Escalara in Santa Fe with Chez Panisse chef David Tanis. Her newest cookbook, In My Kitchen, is a collection of her favorite vegetarian recipes, which reflects an elegant simplicity of technique and also of flavor. So let's talk about vegetables, of course.
Yeah.
What types of techniques and ideas have you borrowed or taken from other cultures? Because other cultures tend to cook vegetables probably better than most people in Northern Europe did, which is where we got most of our recipes initially.
That's true. And I'm still, I think, very Northern European in some of the dishes I like. But what have I used from other people? Well, olive oil. We don't think of it as a vegetable, but it is an oil pressed from a fruit, the olive. We're familiar with it, and we now use it in desserts. And that's a barrier that had to be broken. Hmm. But I think now it's very acceptable. Italy is often the inspiration for that, but not just Italy, also Greece. I think actually my lens is more botanical than anything else. You know, so I tend to look at plants that are in the same family that have a relationship with each other. And that always interests me very much and often guides a dish.
So what would be an example of a family?
Well, an example would be a roasted Jerusalem artichoke soup, which is in the sunflower family. And so I like to finish that with sunflower sprouts, which are big and fleshy and fresh and kind of a nice contrast to the earthiness of the Jerusalem artichokes. And also some sunflower seeds that are toasted and put on top. You know, it kind of ties the whole thing together in a really harmonious and, I think, natural way.
So I grew up with French vinaigrette. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there were other ways to do it. Well, I guess there's ranch dressing, but the rest of the world has lots of other things to say about this. So could you help us out here? So if you have some nice fresh vegetables, or maybe they're blanched, whatever, how do you think about dressing vegetables?
Well, I actually do like a vinaigrette, and I love a shallot vinaigrette, and it's what I turn to time and time and time again. For me, what's important is dressing vegetables while they're warm and not shocking them, which means you kind of have to be able to anticipate you're going to pull them out of the pot when they're hot, and maybe you're going to spread them on a towel and let them finish cooking in their own heat, but dress them before their room temperature. To me, that experience is always the most aromatic, regardless of the dressing using.
I never thought of that. I love the fact that you include in my kitchen a cheese souffle.
Oh, good.
Well, I just thought about, you know, here at Milk Street, we're running around the world trying to get new ideas, but there are things that have stood the test of time that still make a great deal of sense. I just thought, you know what? A cheese souffle, which takes a few minutes to put together, is actually simple, delicious, and a perfect food
item.
It is. I love it. And, you know, people are, I think, so intimidated to make a souffle. And when they're served one, they're in such awe. And it's so simple. And that's why I wanted to put that there, because I really want to encourage people to try it. At the same time, I love to bring a souffle to the table, because when people have dropped in and there's nothing in the house, usually it's going to be a souffle that comes in, and they're happy to have it. It's fun.
You commented that early on when you were cooking at the Zen Center, the feedback was often just needs a little more cheese. And I remember the early Moosewood cookbook. There was a lot of cheese in quote-unquote vegetarian cooking back in the day. Mm-hmm. Have we gotten over that now, finally? Is that?
I think we have. I know, when I was putting this book together, I was looking at one of my favorite recipes. I used to make it greens, and there's cheese in it where it doesn't need to be there. And the line of my recipe was, and the cheese is there to make it more substantial, or something like that. And honestly, I think in 1979, in the early 80s, I was really nervous about what are we going to make for people who aren't vegetarian that they're going to feel satisfied. Well, cheese really filled that bill. But now I don't know. Now you sort of have to apologize if you use it. It seems like we've gone way to the other side. I'm not ready to give up cheese. I grew up on a dairy farm. I love cheese. I love the craft of cheese. I think it's a wonderful food.
You know, I've spoken to a number of people from other cultures, Japan and Vietnam, other places, Thailand, and they all seem to have, the cultures seem to have a feeling about how one approaches cooking, and you're, as you say, a recovering Buddhist. So for you, is it about how you move in the kitchen? Is it about how you think about food? Is it spiritual? Is it just about the food? Is it, what is cooking for you?
Well, I happen to be sort of a mental person, and I maybe spend my day writing and reading, and I am so happy to get into the kitchen where I can touch things and handle things, or go out in the garden and pick what we're having for dinner. For me, it's just such a huge joy to finally be in the kitchen, and it's a relief, too, from the rest of my life. It kind of balances things out a bit. I can pull other people's books off a shelf or look at your magazine and say, oh, what's the adventure here tonight? And I actually love cooking from other people's books, because you're really entering a different mind set. And sometimes I just want to see where it's going to take me.
Okay, it's time for my two de rigueur stupid questions. The first is, are there two or three pantry ingredient items you have on hand you think are essential and that maybe a lot of people don't have, they should?
Well, I'm sure there are. I happen to love unpasteurized soy sauce, which is, it's not that hard to find. I get it at my co-op, you know, and other places too. All it means is you have to keep it in the refrigerator, but it has such a good flavor. I just think it's fantastic. I love to use it. It just seems richer than other kinds of soy sauce. Togoroshi sashimi.
Yep. I love that.
Well, we seem to be in Japan right now, but I always have that in my cupboard now. And
you want to just describe to people what's in that, what the mixture is?
Yeah, a little citrus, chili, seeds of some kind, usually sesame seeds, salt. Sashimi is seven. There's seven ingredients in it, and I can't remember them all right now, but it's spicy and complex, and it can really wake up foods, I think, very nicely. I also have, and I know this is going to sound kind of elitist, but I do have real balsamic vinegar that's made by a person here in central New Mexico, and it's fantastic. And once you've tasted that, you just don't want to taste any other kind of balsamic vinegar. It's so rich and it's so interesting. And just a few drops are all you need to finish a dish. Smoked salt, I haven't used it for a while, but I do have it. And I sometimes, the smoked salt, that's great to use. Smoked paprika, this was a revelation to me, because for a long time, to get smoke into dishes that didn't rely on bacon, you had to use, say, chipotle chilies. So they're smoky, but they're also hot. And so that's fine if you're making chili, but it's maybe not what you always want. So a smoked sweet paprika is a fantastic thing to have.
You've been cooking a long time. There must be, are there a couple of techniques maybe you learned in the restaurant world or things that are techniques that you use all the time, but maybe people are not as familiar with?
Well, I use a lot of herbs, and that's not exactly a technique, but it is an ingredient-driven way of cooking, and I can't imagine not using them. I don't know if that counts in your book, but I grow herbs, I use them, I pick them. They really do so much for me in terms of making a dish come alive. I don't know that I have really unusual techniques, but sometimes a recipe will feature a little different way of thinking about something that I like, the scrambled eggs smothered with crispy breadcrumbs. Mm. It's still eggs and toast.
I love that recipe. I saw that in your book. You've been at the revolution starting in the late 70s. That's about when I got started. And you've seen enormous amount of change. Was there a moment or two in the last, 35 years now, where you realized that things really were changing, or there was a moment that changed you in terms of your career or cooking? What were those moments you go back and think about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, definitely things started to change. I think of Seed Savers Exchange, which started about the same time Zen Center did, and they did so much to bring back the heirloom fruits and vegetables and herbs and flowers that we all enjoy today. That was a significant change. I certainly remember certain ingredients coming into our lives, like sun-dried tomatoes from Italy. I remember when they arrived in San Francisco and Carlo Mignone had a little party and we all tasted them and thought they were amazing. And for me, a personal really changing moment was my first meal at Chez Panisse when I was a Zen student. And I'd pretty much given up on ever really getting to eat out or do anything like that again. And Alice invited me to Chez Panisse, and I went, and this was the food I thought food should always be, and it was just tremendously exciting, and that's what made me, I think, really want to take cooking seriously.
That was Deborah Madison, chef, cooking instructor, and author of her latest book, In My Kitchen. The expression goes, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like, and that, of course, applies to cooking. Great art embodies a clear vision and simplicity of execution that turns a pretty picture into something seminal, even transcendent, and the same can be said of a truly great cookbook. The recipes reflect a point of view about cooking that perfectly captures a moment in time, as well as an effortless mastery of the topic. In My Kitchen by Deborah Madison is one of those books, the personification of simplicity. As they say about music, it's the notes that are not played that really make the song. Right now, I'm headed to Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge to speak with wine expert Stephen Muse about cuvée. Stephen, how are you?
Good, Chris.
White, red, red, red. That's what I see. Four glasses of wine?
Today, we're going to try to elucidate a term that I think all of our listeners have probably heard. The term is cuvée. Sometimes you can see it on the label of a wine bottle, cuvée such and such, right? It's a very old term.
Okay.
And it comes from, it's very simple, the vat in which you put wine to ferment in French is called a cuve, C-U-V-E. Huh. So when wine has been put into a vat and a particular batch of wine has been made, it's a cuvée.
I did not know that.
So, Chris, we're going to taste these four wines, and really what it comes down to is to think of a cuvée as a single package of wine, a single assembling of components that the winemaker has chosen to make a harmonious and agreeable wine. And there are all kinds of ways to slice this. So we're going to begin with the first wine,
okay?
And you're going to give that one a taste.
Lovely, light finish, deep mineral base to it. You could drink this on your own. I may drink the rest of it on my own.
It's a really beautiful little wine. It's made by Sergio Mortora. He's in Umbria. He works with Grechetto grape, and pretty much everything he makes is made with this single grape. But he makes multiple cuvées from Grechetto fruit. Now, the one that distinguishes this in his lineup is that it has added to it a little bit of new oak, something that the other cuvées do not have. Not only can a cuvée be made from different fruit, different varietals, but it can be made in a different way in the cellar. So if a winemaker wants to take a different approach, he makes a separate cuvée. In this case, a Grechetto with a little bit of new
oak. Okay, now I'm confused. So does it have to be the same grape or combination of grapes?
Well, remember, in every case here, we're talking about wine that comes out of a single cellar. And we're talking about, just picture it, separate vats of wine. It does not have to be the same varietal, exactly. It can be handled a little bit differently. It's just the decision that the winemaker makes about wanting to treat one batch of wine a little differently from another.
Okay, so this is the first bottle of white wine.
Right.
And I don't see the word cuvée on the label anywhere.
Right.
Help me out here.
Okay.
So what am I looking for?
Well, sometimes you're going to see the word cuvée on the label. Sometimes you won't see that word.
Yeah.
But this is what wine consumers need to be up to speed on. The wine is going to have two important pieces of information on the label: the estate that produces it, and the appellation, the kind of wine that it is legally. But somewhere in between those, there's going to be another indicator from the winery that says this is a distinct cuvée.
So they could just make up any name they want.
Absolutely. You know, in the Rhone Valley, they often make a cuvée tradition and a cuvée prestige, a lower level and a higher level. But any fantasy name will do.
Okay.
And when you see that on the label, that's your clue that this is one of some number of wines that are produced by that single estate.
So I can see the name of the estate, it says Sauvignon Blanc, but then there's a third piece of information which would tell me that it's a specific cuvée of that, a style of that Sauvignon Blanc.
If there is a third piece of information, that is very likely what it is.
Next glass is red.
So Chris, what you just tasted is Cabernet Franc from the Loire Valley. The estate is Jolin Plaisantin. You can see that on the label. It's a Chinon, that's the appellation. But what do you see in the middle here in big letters?
Les hauts, les bas.
The high and the low together. So this is a cuvée this wine team makes. They make several. But this particular one, it's a combination of fruit from higher and lower altitudes.
I like this wine because it's very smooth. It does have some depth to it, but it's also light and refreshing.
Yes.
But it doesn't have any real strange distinctive characteristics. It's right there in a happy middle.
Yes. Okay. So let's go to wine number three. Also red, Domaine Saladin. In this part of the world, in the Rhone Valley, every wine that you drink, almost without exception, is going to be some kind of cuvée. And that is because the appellation rules require that there be multiple grape varieties involved in the blend. So this is a cuvée that is made in conformity with appellation standards. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was very nice. It was light and lively, but it had a lot of separate flavors and characteristics. Mm-hmm. It was quite good.
And the fourth wine is what I would call a freestyle wine. So this is made in the French Southwest. It's in a location where the appellation rules aren't particularly restrictive. And I want to show you the back label, and you're going to see a group of grapes here that you have never seen in the same bottle of wine before. What does it say there?
Merlot, Pinot Noir. I don't know what that is.
Touriga Raffianal.
That's
a port grape.
Oh.
So first of all, Merlot and Pinot Noir are never in the same wine. And to have two French varieties mixed with a Portuguese variety, very unusual.
Petit Verdot.
Yeah, that's a Bordeaux varietal.
And then Divert.
Yeah, 17% of who knows what. So this is a freestyle blend. I really love it. It's got a lot of body, a lot of character. Did you enjoy it?
I hate to use terms like smoky, leathery, and et cetera, but it does have a lot of that in it.
This is from Terre de Cosse. It's a Vin de France. This is their, the cuvée is there. It's called Bay Pourpre, the Purple Bay.
I'm going to walk away today with a nice buzz.
Yeah.
Because I've had some wine.
Yeah.
But what else am I taking away? Because I'm still a little confused.
Here's what's important about it. It's true that you don't see the word cuvée on every bottle of wine, but you will hear people in a retail shop talk about it. And you should really have a clear understanding of what they're talking about. And what they mean is that on any given wine estate, where there's a multiplicity of fruit, there's a multiplicity of vineyards, they have a little bit of flexibility in the way they can put the wine together, they're going to exercise creativity, and they're going to make multiple lots of the wine based on the sources of fruit that they have.
So here's my Vermont analogy. I go to buy a Ford 250 pickup. I can get the King Ranch edition. I can get this edition. So same fundamental chassis and engine, but you can get lots of different finishes, and they end up looking and feeling quite different.
I like it, Chris. I like that analogy.
I'll give you a Ford 250. You give me the wine, and we're all set. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Chris.
That was wine expert Stephen Muse. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. After the break, more of your cooking questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips@177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Now it's time to take some calls with my learned co-host, Sarah Moulton.
You're so nice.
Welcome to Mill Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Heather calling from Los Angeles, California.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How can I help you?
A lot of the time when I'm preparing recipes, I like to use different spices, and I also include like dried herbs or even lemon peel, like under the umbrella of spices. And I want to know, how can I build spice blends? Because there's really not a set of rules that I've found to create spice blends.
Well, the first thing is a guy in New York whose name is Lior, L-I-O-R, Sercarz, S-E-R-C-A-R-Z, I think. His book is The Spice Companion, and he owns a little store in New York that sells spices and blends. I think he's the best guy in the country for spices, and that book's really interesting, or go to his website. His company's called La Boite, B-O-I-T-E. The other thing I would do is think about different cultures. So Morocco has a certain series of spices that go together, or Sichuan, or Japan, or Thailand, and create spice blends based upon those kinds of recipes, because they've been doing this a long time and things naturally go
together. They sort of know what works.
But the one thing he said to me recently, he said, I will never do a spice blend for fish. And what he meant was, you can use a spice blend for lots of things. So we recently cooked three things, a very one-layer cake, salad dressing over some raw vegetables. We also did some salmon, and we used the same Moroccan blend that I put together with all three, and they were great.
Why wouldn't he do it with fish?
Well, his point was spice blends can be used with lots of different things, but the idea of having just one blend for chicken and one blend for fish.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So in other words, you can use them for lots of different things, sweet things, savory things, salads. So I would do that. Of course, the French don't use spices, so.
But I really love Indian food. So that's where I came to understand much more about spices is through Indian cuisine. And I agree with Chris. It's fun to sort of go to a country and see what they usually put into their spice mix and then customize it for yourself.
The other thing is, of course, if your spices are terrible, then, getting really good stuff and small amounts of them is...
Small amounts is key.
Very small amounts, and pay the money and get the good stuff, and it'll make a huge difference in your cooking. Last suggestion is get real cinnamon, not that garbage that we use over here, but it's very floral and fruity and almost savory, is the Ceylon cinnamon, I think. And try that.
Sri Lanka.
That's just a wonderful thing to use as well. One last thought. Salt and pepper, it came from Northern Europe where there was a lot of pepper, but just forget about salt and pepper. It's a dumb old idea.
Well, don't forget about salt, because salt
is
key.
But it doesn't have
pepper
to go with pepper.
Pepper should only be used where necessary.
But there's Sichuan pepper, there's Urfa pepper, there's Aleppo, there's all sorts
there's
of different
things.
There's
all these cool peppers,
Or spicy paprika.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a really great tip, because I do realize now that I have a tendency to kind of use pepper in almost everything.
We all do.
I probably shouldn't be.
No.
Well, in the Middle East, they'll use salt and cumin. Other cultures don't use pepper like we do.
Yeah.
Give that a shot.
Perfect. All okay, right. Thanks so much.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hello, who's calling?
Hi, this is Gwen Willman.
Hi, Gwen. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Central Alabama.
Nice.
As you can probably tell.
Well, yes, a little bit from the accent. I wouldn't have been able to place it that exactly, but how can we help you?
I have a question. What is the correct way to boil chicken breast to ensure that the meat's tender? I've tried cooking it longer, shorter, adding a little oil, but nothing works. It's always very dense and tough.
Let me ask you a question. So when you boil it, are you actually boiling it? I mean, like you see big bubbles like you're boiling noodles or something.
Yes.
That is the problem right there. Protein does not like to be boiled. It gets very tough. And particularly something as lean as white meat chicken.
Yes.
So I would recommend reducing the temperature and simmering it gently.
Is this boneless, skinless chicken breast, or it's a whole chicken?
It is.
Well, this is the perfect candidate for sous vide, which I know, you're not going to go out and buy a sous vide circulator. They cost $100 or so. But you can put it in water and bring the water up with the chicken in it to 175 degrees. Let it sit there for a while, 10 or 15 minutes, I've forgotten the timing, until the chicken itself is up to temperature, which is 165 or so, 170. But if you do it that way, it's not boiling. It's not even simmering. It's 175, and it's very gentle cooking. That'll give you the best chicken.
Wonderful. My mother was a wonderful cook, and she had the most delicious boiled chicken. It had almost a buttery taste to it.
Let me ask you another question, Gwen. When your mom cooked it, when you cook it, do you both cook it in water?
Yes.
Because you might want to try poaching it in chicken broth.
Another thing. She had, when she boiled her chicken, of course, she boiled it in water, and it made a delicious
broth. Yeah.
But did she do boneless, skinless chicken breasts? I doubt it. you might want to, you know, stop doing boneless, skinless chicken breasts and do a whole chicken.
If you do a whole chicken, put the whole chicken in water, just simmering for half an hour, turn off the heat and let it sit about 45 minutes or so until it comes up to temperature. It'll be perfectly cooked. And then you can take the meat off the bone and do what you want. I totally agree with Sarah. Start with a whole chicken, 30 minutes at a very low simmer. Turn the heat off, let it sit for 45 minutes or so until it comes up to temperature.
And if you want to make it even more interesting, you could throw in a little bit of carrot, celery, onion, maybe a smashed garlic clove, some fresh thyme or parsley.
Or ginger if you like a Chinese.
Want to go Asian. Yeah. But you know, the real thing, so where all that flavor comes from in a stock is, well, fat, but also the wonderful texture that comes from the bones.
Yeah, definitely do the whole chicken, and then you have a whole chicken.
Yeah.
You got more food.
Yeah, and you can always freeze it after you've cooked it if you can't eat it all at one fell swoop.
And then you have soup.
Right. Yes. You're going to be a happy camper when you go back to chicken on the bone.
Oh, yes. I think this will be much more like what I remember, what I grew up eating. Yes, wonderful.
Okay, well,
Gwen, thank you.
Thanks, Gwen.
Thank you very much. I enjoy your show.
Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye now.
This is Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. If you'd like your cooking question answered, give us a ring at 1-855-4-BOWTIE. That's 855-426-9843. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
This is Julia Hanna calling from Acton, Massachusetts.
Okay, that's sort of your neck of the woods there, right, Chris?
It's right next door, yes. How can we help you?
Yes.
I made your foolproof pie crust in the first issue of the magazine, and the texture is definitely better than what I usually get, but I still had quite a lot of shrinkage.
Yep.
I'm wondering if maybe I should have chilled the dough a little longer, or what I could have done to make it not shrink up quite so much when it comes out of the oven.
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, a few things. When you fit the dough into the pie plate, be sure you press the sides down into the plate, because if they're sort of stretched when you put them in, they tend to shrink. So push down a little bit.
Okay.
How long did you leave it in the fridge? Like half an hour?
I think I did whatever the recommended amount was. Yeah, probably about 30 minutes.
Well, if you can leave it overnight, that's even better. But leave it an hour. And then I would stick it in the freezer for like 20 minutes as well.
Oh, okay.
Now, did you pre-bake the shell?
I did. I made the brown butter
the custard
that you had with it.
Well, another thing you can do is put aluminum foil, of course, on the pie shell.
Right.
If you fill it with weights about 3/4 full, that really helps. We found if it was only halfway, it wasn't as good. Don't use metal weights. They didn't work as well as ceramic or rice or beans.
Okay.
And the last thing is, before you take it out of the oven and take the foil off, lift off foil around the edge and make sure that the pie dough is set. Because very often what happens after 20 minutes or so, if you take the foil off, it's still a little wet and it's not fully set. But if you let it really set and get dry with the foil on it and the weights in it, it'll set. You shouldn't get more than 10 or 15% shrinkage if you do it that way.
This is a single crust pie, is that right?
Yes.
Something we used to do at La Tulipe, a restaurant I worked at, because even if you do everything right, it's going to shrink somewhat. Besides, I really agree with Chris about not stretching it, not pulling it, because it will bounce back, is to put the edge up higher than you want it to be, so that when the top edge does shrink, it will shrink down to where it should have been. If it never shrunk. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. Yeah. I do. Well, it's good to know that even in very nice restaurants, pie crusts shrink and you have to outwit them.
All pre-baked shells will shrink somewhat. Yeah. The key is they don't shrink so much that they can't contain the filling.
Yeah.
And that particular recipe you talk about, the brown sugar, is a very thin filling. So it's not a problem like a pumpkin pie or something.
Right.
No, that was a delicious
recipe
despite the shrinkage.
Yes. Well, we've given you all the tricks, so I'm sure next time you won't have that problem.
Yes, I know I'm going to do better next time.
Well, that's why we cook.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, when you serve it, nobody will know.
Oh, and don't apologize.
Yeah, nobody will know if it shrunk a little.
It's a perfect pie every time you serve it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a no-apology baker.
Good for you. Good for you. Okay.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Julia.
This is Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. If you like your cooking question answered, call us anytime, 1-855-4-BOWTIE or 855-426-9843. 3. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. This week's Milk Street Basic is aerating red wine. Everyone knows that when you open a bottle of red wine, it's good to let it breathe. That way, the flavor of the wine really comes out. The problem is, if you simply take the cork out, the neck of the bottle is so narrow that very little oxygen gets into the wine itself. You can let that bottle sit for an hour and the wine will not have changed. So here's a better solution. Take 2 water carafes or pitchers, pour the wine out of the bottle into one of the pitchers, and pour it back and forth about 10 times. This will expose the wine to a lot of oxygen, opening up its flavor. Now, if you're not convinced this works, the next time you have a bottle of red wine, take out the cork, pour out a small amount into a glass, and then with the rest of it, pour it back and forth. And then do a taste test. Believe me, you'll find that the wine that's been aerated tastes much better. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Nancy Silverton opened La Brea Bakery in 1989 in Los Angeles, and since then has become one of America's most accomplished bread bakers. Currently paired up with Mario Batali at Osteria Moza and Pizzeria Moza, Nancy is still doing what she loves best, which is baking bread. Today at Milk Street, she chats about sourdough, about pizza, and about the time she made Julia Child cry. Welcome to Milk Street.
Glad to be here.
So I know you're famous for your pizza dough. If you're talking to me or anybody else who's not at your level, is there some basic guidelines, things you could tell us that would get us in the ballpark of good pizza?
All I know that the ingredients in my dough are a wheat flour. I put a touch of rye in there to help with the fermentation and also to make the flour itself look a little bit dustier, but not a lot of rye. I put in wheat germ, and the reason I put in wheat germ is I like the little sweetness of the germ, added germ, even though there's already, you know, I'm using a white flour, not a wheat flour, so the germ has been removed and the bran, but I'm putting a little bit of the sweetness of the germ back in and a touch of malt. But that's it. So there's no olive oil in the dough. It might be the amount of time I allow it to ferment.
So you just put in some of the water, let the sponge sit, and then...
Yes, some of the water, some of the... Oh, and yeast, of course. So it's not a sourdough crust, so there's also yeast in the dough.
So the concept of sourdough, unless you have a starter, is you're trying to attract wild yeast spores, is that right?
Uh-huh. You are the creator of your own leavening, you know, your own yeast.
So could you just... I've read a little bit about this, and I've tried it with grapes, and I've tried it with this and that, and the other thing, potato... How does that work? How do you attract them? Just explain it to the rest of us who don't really get it, maybe.
Well, you know, when I was, for instance, teaching myself how to bake bread, I really literally started with a teaspoon of this and a sprinkle of that. And every single day I would just make little changes, knowing in the end what I wanted. I also knew from things that I had read about Stephen Sullivan was that the texture of his starter was... a slurry, sort of the texture of a pancake batter. And so what I did is I mixed flour and water together until it was that texture. I bundled up a bunch of grapes. And what the grapes do is simply to help sort of jumpstart that process, sort of twofold. One is that there's natural and beneficial bacteria on the skins of grapes, but also the juice from the grapes provide extra food for the yeast to grow and multiply.
This is a story that you've repeated, I know, but I got this story from Julia Child's producer, Jeff Drummond. And it just was one of those great stories when you made that secret brioche tart or whatever with a white sauce and on Baking with Julia, I guess, and Julia bit into it and everyone thought that she burned her mouth because she started crying. And it wasn't that. It was that you had reminded her of some wonderful taste memory from France. I just love that story. Could you just tell us the first-person version of it?
Well, you did a good job, by the way. But besides the fact that it was great to be on her show, I was making this dessert for her. And before we started the filming, she, you know, let me know that she liked to film as close to live as possible, meaning as little editing as possible. So she wanted the episode to take whatever it was supposed to take, say half an hour. And she said in order to be successful, and make it in that half an hour, you know, a few minutes before we need to wrap up, I'll tap you on the hip, and that means you have 3 minutes. And so I was, you know, carefully finishing this dessert, and one of the elements was sautéed stoned fruit in a wine and sugar syrup, which meant that that stoned fruit is piping hot, right? And that's when I got that tap that finished the dessert and let me taste it. And so I, you know, spooned it out of the pan and I spooned it over the brioche tart and put a dollop of the zabaione and some almonds and some powdered sugar. And she cut it and she ate it so quickly. And then I saw these tears flowing down her cheeks, and I was just aghast. And I'm looking at her, and I'm looking at her tears, and you can see in my face is like, uh-oh, what is happening here? And then she said, this is a dessert to cry over, you know, and then I'm like,
gone from the very bottom, the depths of despair, to the heights of culinary stardom.
Yes, and by the way, I sort of always use it as what, when asked by a journalist what my crowning moment was, I always say, you know, it was the time that I made Julia Childs cry.
That was La Brea Bakery's Nancy Silverton. Earlier in the show, I spoke with Deborah Madison, which made me think, oddly enough, about getting old. And I mean old as a cook. You know, at some point, older cooks arrive. They arrive at a point of simplicity and economy. Baked ricotta with thyme, caramelized onion frittata. No extra ingredients, no wasted steps, a clear sense of culinary purpose. Deborah Madison has arrived. That's it for this week on Milk Street Radio. If you missed us this week, you can listen to all of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Spotify. Our shows are also downloadable on our brand new website. Please check it out, 177milkstreet.com. That's where we also post all the recipes you hear on this show. Thanks for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producers Melissa Baldino and Stephanie Stender. Producer Amy Padula. Production assistant Carly Helmetog. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugarts. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison, with help from Vicky Merrick and Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help Debbie Paddock. Theme music by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.